we're going to look real hard at academic and administrative programs across the entire university system.
The new University of Alaska president looks for places to cut the budget. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, September 9th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, taxpayers in Anchorage will pay more for this year's school bond.
Taxpayers will see a small bump because of their approval of the bond proposal.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
There is still time to start the Business Administration and Management program at Alaska Pacific University. Module 2 courses start on Wednesday, October 21st. More at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
A federal judge in Anchorage has ruled against a group from King Cove seeking an emergency road to Cold Bay. Judge H. Russell Holland says Interior Secretary Sally Jewell's 2013 decision to reject an 11-mile road through the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge is in keeping with the National Environmental Policy Act, known as NEPA. The judge says, given the sensitive nature of the lands in the proposed road corridor, the need to follow NEPA probably doomed the project. Judge Holland wrote, "Perhaps Congress will now think better of its decision to encumber the King Cove Road project with a NEPA requirement." Senator Lisa Murkowski says she was disappointed with the decision, but she's already working on a congressional solution. She has inserted a rider in a spending bill that would allow a land exchange and take the road decision away from the Interior Secretary. King Cove residents want a road to reach Cold Bay's long paved runway to allow medical evacuations in rough conditions. King Cove Mayor Henry Mack spoke of the need in a call-in to APRN's Talk of Alaska this week.
"We would love to get our sick grandmas and grandpas and young children who need to get out safely instead of waiting in a clinic and miserable nights, bad weather, where we could drive over there."
The city joined with local tribes and the Aleutian East Borough to bring the legal challenge. They say they're evaluating their next legal move. Environmental groups argue that a road would diminish important waterfowl habitat. They say most of the world's population of Pacific black brant and emperor geese rest and feed in the Eisenbeck Refuge during migrations. Tim Woody, spokesman for the Alaska branch of the Wilderness Society, says their position does not amount to placing bird needs above human needs.
"Everyone is respectful of King Cove's concerns and their needs for emergency transportation, but we need to start looking for a solution that meets their needs while keeping the wilderness of the refuge intact."
Woody says other transportation methods like helicopter service or a ferry might serve the community better, but road proponents say those alternatives aren't realistic. The process of downsizing the University of Alaska continues. Decreased state tax revenue because of low crude oil prices has resulted in less money for the university, and there's no sign of that changing. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the focus of the university's reorganization is shifting.
The last 2 years have seen program and job reductions at individual University of Alaska campuses, and new UA President Jim Johnson says the next round of cuts will have a more statewide focus.
"We're going to look real hard at academic and administrative programs across the entire university system. So far, a lot of those reviews have taken place at the universities, and they have organized the reviews and the analysis and the reductions. We're going to step that up a bit, and we're going to look across the entire university system. We're going to look at enrollments. We're going to look at cost effectiveness. We're going to look at quality. We're going to look at access. So there will be reorganization across the university system."
Johnson says the goal is to deliver top-notch programs while cutting costs, and that will likely mean consolidation of some programs.
"I believe that we'll always have Program X in Alaska. It may not be at 3 campuses. It may not be at 5 campuses, however. So we have to do a hard look at those kinds of things across the state."
Johnson says that unfortunately will also mean more job losses.
"But my commitment to the people of the University of Alaska is that we will have transparent processes processes for making these decisions. We will be inclusive, so there will be, we're not hiding anything. We're going to let people know, and we're going to be upfront with what we're doing. And I think that's the only way to respect the people who've worked for the university for years and years and who may be affected by these negative conditions out there in our economy.
Johnson would not put a timeline on the next round of cuts, but says the downsizing analysis is already underway. He adds that cutting isn't the only focus and also highlights a new fundraising effort to reach beyond corporate donors to individual citizens, including alumni, for support. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
As autumn sets in, students and faculty are back in the classrooms of the University of Alaska Anchorage for the fall semester. And members of the engineering department are settling into their new state-of-the-art building. APRN's Josh Edge toured their new digs.
The first room we come to is called the High Bay, which spans three floors for nearly the entire length of the building. As we walk in the door, a hoist capable of moving 10 tons to almost anywhere in the room hovers above our heads, holding a steel bridge designed by students. At the end of the room is a machine dubbed the Strong Floor, where students and staff test the strength of anything from wooden beams to reinforced concrete by determining the breaking point. Engineering professor Andrew Metzger says these tests have practical, real-world applications.
Before we specify them or install them in the field, they need to know how strong they are, so to make sure the wind doesn't push so hard that it fails them, or on a floor if it can support whatever's on the floor.
The brand new 80,000 square foot engineering and industry building triples the engineering department space on campus. The number of students in the program have more than tripled over the last 15 years. Additional emphasis on labs allows students opportunities to apply what's taught in the classroom in ways that were not possible on campus until just a few weeks ago. Right now, students are preparing to test the strength of a 4-foot by 12-foot insulated panel, which Metzger says could be used as part of a wall, floor, or ceiling.
They're going to load it until the panel breaks, and then they know how strong it is.
Slowly, a jack pushes down, applying pressure to the panel. As more force is applied, the panel starts to bend and crack until the panel breaks in half, crashing to the floor under more than 5,400 pounds of pressure. This is one of many ways engineering students will be able to turn the theoretical knowledge of the classroom into firsthand practical experience. The new building boasts several other labs for everything from fluid dynamics to radio frequency to electromagnetics. And for those uniquely Alaskan construction problems, the Cold Regions Engineering Lab, or Cold Room for short. Fred Barlow is the dean of the College of Engineering.
You might be testing a pavement for a roadway, concrete samples for a building. You might be testing those insulated panels or something that you just saw break. So there's lots of applications where you need to know what happens to those materials, let's say over long periods of time, and the kinds of conditions you'd find in northern Alaska.
And the cold room allows students, researchers, and faculty members to simulate those conditions. Among the labs in the approximately $78 million building are plenty of classrooms, some of them even equipped with video conferencing so long-distance students can attend lectures, and lots of open study space for the program's 1,200-plus students, complete with a coffee shop. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, learning to work with otter pelts in Heidelberg.
I don't know, I can't decide whether it's going to be a hat or a scarf.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
A driver was killed and a passenger injured after they exchanged gunfire with Alaska State Troopers and Fairbanks Police following a vehicle chase in Fairbanks this morning. Trooper spokeswoman Megan Peters says the incident started at about 9 a.m. with the attempted pullover of a vehicle for a basic traffic violation.
The stop was for failure to use a turn signal. The vehicle immediately began eluding troopers, and a few minutes into the pursuit, shots were fired towards troopers from the vehicle by both the driver and the single passenger. More troopers and Fairbanks PD were advised of the situation, and attempts to stop the vehicle using tire deflation devices failed. The vehicle finally came to a stop at Dennis Road and Bradway Road. Shots were exchanged between law enforcement and the suspects. The active situation was over at 9:38.
Peters says no law enforcement officers were injured in the incident, but would not provide any additional information. The situation prompted the Fairbanks School District to initiate a lockdown, but the situation was resolved before it was implemented at all sites. The shooting follows a similar incident in South Fairbanks yesterday, in which an armed man in a vehicle was shot by Alaska State Troopers. Only cursory information is available in that case as well. The state's Department of Education won't reimburse two school districts for voter-backed school bonds. It's an uncommon move, with districts usually relying on the state to pay a majority of the costs for bonds covering capital projects. Anchorage voters approved a nearly $60 million bond in April that will pay for building upgrades at eight schools. But since an August letter from the Education Department informed the school district they won't be reimbursed, Meyer Hutchinson, spokesman for the mayor's office, says the full cost will be spread across residents' property taxes.
Taxpayers will see a small bump because of their approval of the bond proposal.
That measure was approved within the same span of time that legislators passed a five-year moratorium on school bonding. At the time, many were unsure what it could mean for the Anchorage School District's proposal, but with news coming in August that the administration won't agree to the reimbursements, Hutchinson says the mayor's office is working with the school district to discuss the issue with the governor and legislators.
We're really hoping that the legislature and the governor can extend the same kind of certainty that we afford the oil industry in Alaska to our school children.
But projects across the district will go ahead as planned. That's not the case for the state's only other bonding district. In Bristol Bay, the lack of reimbursement will stop plans to bring the school in Naknek up to code. Bristol Bay Borough voters approved a proposal for a $14 million bond to pay to bring the school up to code and make it more energy efficient. Those plans are now on hold.
That retroactive moratorium really, you know, put the kibosh on the project.
District Superintendent Bill Hill says it was frustrating to learn of the Education Department's decision after the district had put time and resources into planning the school improvements.
You know, it's not an easy process to go through. We hired a firm to do design and development. The borough spent hundreds of thousands of dollars getting us to a 35% design on the project. We expended a lot of personnel time, not just my own, but the borough manager. We involved our community in the development of the project, so there was a lot of effort in this.
The district's single school in Naknek has many systems overdue for repair or replacement. Hill says the windows, doors, lights, fans, heating, and roofing all need work. In a borough with a year-round tax base of less than 1,000 residents, Hill says the district will have to keep looking outside for funding to make those improvements. Karuna Jagger wants to provide a counter-narrative to the pink ribbon culture, also known as the tyranny of cheerfulness. Jagger is executive director of Breast Cancer Action, a national education and advocacy organization. She was part of a panel that toured Alaska this month called What the Pink? KTOO's Lisa Fu reports.
Standing at a venue in Juneau, Jagger tells the small audience where the pink ribbon came from. She says it originates with a woman in California named Charlotte Haley,
who was upset that so many women in her family and community were diagnosed with breast cancer, and she was outraged that so little money went to research and prevention.
Haley started a peach-colored ribbon campaign from her living room. She sent out postcards with five ribbons attached, calling on the National Cancer Institute to allocate more money to breast cancer prevention. The peach ribbons caught on. It was the early 1990s. The AIDS awareness movement was being propelled by the red ribbon. Jagger says Haley got a lot of national attention.
Self Magazine and Estee Lauder, the cosmetics company, heard about this, and they had begun to do some breast cancer work, and they approached her, wanted to partner. She said no, they were too corporate for her.
The magazine and the cosmetic company went with Pink instead. It was then, Jagger says, that the focus on prevention turned into a focus on awareness. She says the pink ribbon has been used by the corporate world to sell products.
It really binds together the cancer industry, where the corporate polluters are bound together with many of the nonprofit organizations in a really vicious profit cycle.
She says the pink ribbon culture tends to celebrate survivors and perpetuate the idea that women can beat breast cancer.
We're all told to be positive and fight and keep a smile on our face and look good. Do those makeup tips, stay positive.
Jagger says using the term survivor implies that those who died did something wrong.
Are we telling them they didn't fight hard enough? Are we telling them they didn't have a good enough attitude?
One woman at the panel discussion says Jagger changed her mind.
Up until an hour ago, I identified as a breast cancer survivor, but I guess I'm going to change that. But when I would say that to people, they say, oh, congratulations. And it's, I didn't do anything.
Despite pink ribbon awareness, the rates of breast cancer haven't decreased. They've increased. And Jagger says knowledge of what causes it is still largely unknown.
The biggest risk factor is being a woman and getting older.
Jagger wants to flip the pink ribbon on its head and bring the focus back onto breast cancer prevention and not just awareness. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you.
These days, being into STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, doesn't make a girl a geek, it makes the world a better place. If you like numbers, nature, computers, and figuring out how the world really works, go to beanengineeralaska.com. You just might like what you learn. And it's not just for girls. This message on Alaska Public Media brought to you by ExxonMobil in Alaska.
Sea otters have the thickest fur of any mammal, which makes it a valuable commodity. On a recent rainy evening in Heidelberg, local natives gathered for a sea otter sewing class to expand their marketing potential. KRBD's Ruth Eddy has more.
Spread out on a table are a few dark brown soft pelts, 10,000 hairs per square inch. The sea otter furs are worth about $250 each. But each pelt can be made into several small items, which can sell for around $300 each. Student Anna Frisbee stands over a pelt with a metal ruler and an X-Acto knife while she cuts her piece, and others look on.
Don't be scared, Anna. See, it's not cutting through. It's just tiny bits.
You have to hold it down really hard.
Check that.
The students of the class were encouraging each other, because the teacher was absent due to personal reasons. For most of the dozen students, it was their first time handling sea otter fur, including Stacy Scan, who Frisbee convinced to go.
I was a nervous wreck coming the first time to this class. I was like, oh my gosh, I don't even know. So we haven't sewn anything in a long time.
But on the second day of a three-day class, Scan relaxed on a couch in the Tribal Community Center, smiling and stitching. The class is a collaboration between several nonprofits, Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium's Traditional Foods Program donated the pelts, the Heidelberg Cooperative Association donated the space, and Lisa Lang from Hadas Kilkuyas put all the pieces together to organize the event.
Cottage
industries. That's what it's about, is what's local and then bringing it so that you create your own economy.
She says almost everyone in Heidelberg is an artist, pointing out a carver and a weaver, and she wants to create an artist's economy. For Lang, an economy means more than money.
There's over 200 native villages in Alaska, and there's no economies, and so people are leaving and they're losing their culture, their language, and they're losing everything, and they want to be at home.
The first night of the class, students added trims of sea otter fur to knit hats and headbands as a donation to the newly formed artist co-op. The second night, was for making products of their choice.
I don't know. I can't decide whether it's going to be a hat or a scarf.
Cutting and sewing the pelt transforms it into native handicraft, which can be legally sold to non-natives. According to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, authentic native handicraft products have been significantly altered from their original form. Basically, super glue won't do. But it was joked about as some had trouble sewing.
But how about this part? How do I do this part? Just whip
oh,
it?
Oh, yeah, all I've been doing is just that straight stitch.
In addition to creating sellable products, the class was an opportunity to learn some Haida language.
Okay, you guys have to learn the Haida word now, okay? You ready?
Yes.
Huh? Haikwa. Haikwa. Haikwa means are you ready?
I need haikwa. Haikwa. I need a longer one than this.
As well as socialize.
They frown at you if you don't talk while you're working. And then they'll pick on you until you start doing it.
Scan recently moved from Anchorage to the small village on the south end of Prince of Wales Island. She was anxious at first about the drastic change of pace, but so far hasn't had trouble keeping busy.
Yeah, there's actually a lot to do. There really is. I was really worried about that, but little things like this, I think it's really nice, and I don't know, I think it's kind of the glue that keeps the community going, honestly.
There will be another sewing class next month, and Lang is gathering equipment and teachers for other classes such as paddle making, cedar weaving, and deer meat preparation. Lang says with each cedar hat and otter fur bag, Heidelberg is a step closer to the goal of creating a cultural tourism industry. Reporting from Ketchikan, I'm Ruth Eddy.
Valdez residents are mourning the loss of an individual who not only helped put Valdez on the map as a top destination for backcountry skiers, but also continually gave to the community, making it a better place to live. 62-year-old Karen Stewart died Monday night while riding on an all-terrain vehicle trail just outside of downtown Valdez. KCHU's Marsha Lynn reports.
Stewart and her late husband, Ryan McCune, plus a core of other outdoor enthusiasts, founded the World Extreme Skiing Championships held in Valdez from 1991 to 2001. Dean Cummings, a world-class skier and racer, was lured to Valdez for the event. He now operates a heli-ski company, dropping thrill-seekers on the snow-laden peaks of Thompson Pass.
You know, it was a crazy idea. I mean, no skier in the world really thought that Alaska had great skiing. All they thought was Alaska Range, Denali, more the big extreme skiing type stuff, and otherwise most mountains would just be windblown in the dark.
Cummings says it was their down-home approach to visiting skiers that got him hooked.
They were the ones that met you at the airport and wouldn't let you carry your bags and introduced you to everybody at every counter and took us to their home first. Here's where we live, and if you need anything at all, if you need to ride up to the pass, to go skiing, to go get warmed up, to start looking at the mountains, let us know if you need to borrow a car. And you came here, and it was friendlier and more adventurous than any other place I'd ever visited.
During its decade-long run, the Extreme Ski Championships attracted thousands of competitors, spectators, and filmmakers such as Warren Miller. Cummings says Stewart worked tirelessly to make them successful.
She was just the matriarch of it all. She just was the one that would drop everything and go pick somebody up at the airport or would work till 2 in the morning to make sure that they could get some press here, get a TV crew into town for the event, try to line people out in the community as far as volunteers go and getting food up on the mountain and safety equipment.
Alyeska Pipeline Company, where Stewart worked for many years in a variety of jobs, issued a statement saying her sunny, enthusiastic personality will be missed among co-workers and the entire community. In Valdez, I'm Marsha Lynn.
For the first time last month, Huna hosted an 8.3-mile foot race called Jeet's Challenge. The course begins near sea level, runs through town, and then up a mountain to the finish line. The race winners lit mountaintop signal fires echoing events from a Tlingit story. From there, runners hopped into harnesses and zip-lined back down to Icy Strait Point, which is Huna Totem Corporation's salmon cannery turned tourist attraction. The run and zipline ride were part of Icy Strait Point's annual Neighbors Day event, a package day trip out of Juneau. KTOO's Jeremy Shea was there.
1, 2, 3, enjoy the ride. Bye bye.
In the world. It's a 1,300-foot drop, and about a mile long in Huna. In under 90 seconds, I'll be back down at sea level. But right now, I'm cruising down at about 60 miles an hour.
In 2014, about 13,000 people rode the Icy Strait Point Zip Rider, generating an estimated $1.6 million in revenue. That's according to Terra Nova LLC of Utah, which built it in 2007. Until 2014, it was the longest zipline in the world. That's when another Terra Nova-built zipline opened that's a mile and a half long in Mexico's Copper Canyon. Nowadays, there's still some Icy Strait Point advertising and signage around calling it the longest zipline in the world, but it's being phased out and replaced with
the world's largest zipline ride.
That's Tyler Hickman, Vice President of Operations at Icy Strait Point. He explains the distinction.
We have six cables that are side by side, and each cable is 5,330 feet each. So each cable is over a mile long. The one claim that is absolute is we have the most rideable cable in the world. So 6 miles of cable, nobody even comes close to that.
Hickman was one of 89 runners to take Jeet's Challenge. He says 187 people rode over from Juneau for Neighbors Day, their biggest turnout ever. Hickman says he's probably zipped down more than 100 times, and every time, it's still awesome. Here's what the end of my first ride sounded like.
From the Icy Strait Point Zip Rider in Huna, I'm Jeremy Shea.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Ross in Fairbanks, Hannah Colton in Dillingham, Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Ruth Eddy in Ketchikan, Marsha Lynn in Valdez, and Jeremy Shea in Juneau. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C., and Josh Edge from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Gokey is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Raven Alaska, providing business travel needs in over 100 communities across the state. Find more at flyraven.com. Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983. On the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Crowley, providing marine petroleum distribution and energy support services throughout Alaska since 1953, supporting business development while helping safeguard the environment. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
Broken hips and head injuries can have life-altering effects, especially for older adults. But no matter how old you are, it's important to be physically active to prevent injuries. Activity can also increase your strength, balance, and can be done at any age. Ask your healthcare provider about activities that will improve your health. Learn more about starting a new activity at injuryprevention.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.